Here is one question that has appeared about 10 times in different forms. How would you suggest imparting these teachings to children? I assume that either you live with children or that you work with children or that you may have the desire perhaps to write a book for children, whatever. If you live with children or work with children, then of course primary in imparting the teachings to children is not through words but through living the teaching. Especially applies if you have children at home. If you live presence, if you embody living presence, then they will catch it from you. And you don't need to say that much, but there may be moments when they are receptive and perhaps a word or two may come out of your mouth pointing to presence, because the children live in a culture that knows as yet nothing of presence. It is likely that they go to a school that is dominated by nervous mind energy, unless you have chosen already a relatively conscious school for them. They do exist here and there. But if not, if they are still part of the mainstream culture, then in a way you need to counteract that at home. That otherwise they will be very nervous children, because school is making them tense, stressed, and nervous. So most homes lack presence, and when you go in there you see in many cases it's a madhouse. It's your job to bring in presence. And again we come back now to what we just spoke of in the previous question, giving your children your fullest attention is the greatest gift. Many parents these days never listen to their children because they have that's the next thing already that they need to do, and they are busy anyway. How was school? Oh, okay. And what do you have to do now? Okay. Never, when in the listening, it doesn't matter so much what the children are telling you. What matters is that the space that arises as you listen, the spacious presence that arises as you listen to the child, giving them space to be. Oh. That's how the teachings are imparted, by living it in that way. Perhaps also certain things, if you have very young children, where the mind is just starting up in them, to see if you can keep them aware that words and concepts are never the reality, are not everything. Particularly at a stage when they demand to be fed with words and concepts. When they're at the age where they ask, what's this? What's that for? What's that? And 100 times a day they ask, what's that? Because they're quickly, the mind is absorbing. It needs to do that, it seems. The mind is absorbing words. It wants to know. But the openness also disappears. So when you teach new words or show them this is that, what's this? There's so much you can say about this leaf to a child instead of saying, it's a leaf. As you say it, you put it in the child's hand. You encourage the child to look so that the child does not stop looking the moment he or she has learned the word. Because that's what the mind does. The true looking isn't happening anymore. The word takes the place of the reality. It becomes immediately a screen. And so that to reduce that, when you explain as much as you can, you may not be able to do it all the time, but when you explain something, stay with the reality And perhaps instead of saying, it's a leaf, you say, we call it a leaf. Because it's not a leaf. This is the illusion that when you attach a word to something, you know what it is. You have no idea what it is, you've just attached a word to it. And that's how people live. They live in this make-believe world that they know. All they have is a collection of labels. And so that doesn't happen to the child. See, if, as you teach language and words and concepts, see if you can keep the child in touch with the reality that is more alive, deeper, more mysterious than any concept. And here you can teach so much. You can teach the child to, can you see the colors? And can you see the shadings here? Isn't it beautiful? Can you feel that? Yes, it's called a leaf, but can you feel it? Can you see the colors? And do you know what's happening to it? No. Why is it so beautiful? What's happening to it? It's dying. It's dying. Soon it'll be gone. And then the child may ask another, dying? What's that? Well, I'm not saying what words will come out of your mouth because you will be present at that moment. But then through this little thing where before you said, that's a leaf, or you might even know what tree it is, so you have attached another label to it. So you can give labels, the mind needs it, but there's far more. Always remind the child, point out that which is beyond the words and concepts. And so that would be wonderful for a child to grow up in that way, so that the mind is not totally possessed by words and concepts. So it remains, the seeing remains, the hearing remains. You hear a bird, and then encourage the child to hear more. To hear, can you hear? Encourage. And children will be receptive to that. Of course, there are many things in our culture that are there to stimulate the mind, to draw them out of their body. To teach a child to feel the body, they are very ready to feel that, make it into a little game. Can you feel the inner body? Can you feel the aliveness that's there? And they can, and they will love it. And then, if possible, reduce the amount of gadgets they play with, because they all work on the level of abstraction. Computer screens, video game screens, TV, pulling them out of their body, pulling their attention out into some hypnotic trance that gives them a secondary feeling of false aliveness. The video game. So much so that when they stop playing, they don't feel alive anymore. I need some other fix now. This is what the culture is doing to the children. I need another stimulus, another fix, otherwise they will feel dead. And then they look for the next thing, and there's plenty of things. Switch something on. Put headphones on. And then you teach the children about the pain body. Children have them too. Some more than others. So when the child goes into a rage or a screaming fit, or maybe the pain body will take a different form, the child totally withdraws into a corner and doesn't want to talk anymore. at the slightest, the slightest thing might provoke the pain body. It's the same with adults. And there's then far more pain than you could ever have imagined coming out of that little situation. Some children become screaming monsters for a few minutes. In the middle of it, you can't say anything. But when it subsided, you can say, what was that? Where did that come from? What did that feel like? Does it feel good? And so you can direct attention within when the pain body is not active. And then say, do you think it may happen again? Shall we see if it happens again? And we can catch it when just it starts. And next time, you can see, child starts, oh, is it back? Maybe it has a name. The red big monster back? Oh, can you feel it? Not at that point, whether they say they can feel it or not depends to what extent the pain body has already taken possession of their mind. If they scream at you when you ask, can you feel it? Then it's too late to feel it. Or they throw something. And then again afterwards, you say, what was that? It was back, wasn't it? And then you say, did you notice that mommy or daddy also has that? Do you remember the other day when mommy screamed at you or mommy dropped something and started shouting and screaming at daddy? Threw him out of the house. That was the same thing. Mummy didn't catch it then either. And so how wonderful if a child can grow up in a conscious environment, family, surroundings, that way. Not necessarily totally enlightened, just conscious. Not necessarily a family with continuous and permanent peace throughout. So that is imparting the teaching to children. Present moment, direct their attention, redirect their attention to present moment again and again. This, to looking, to listening, to touching. Away from how you reduce the amount they spend addicted to the screens and electronic things, you have to somehow do it and replace it with something more vital, more alive. And they can feel that it's more vital and more alive. Pain bodies have an enormous capacity to pull you in. Even the pain body of a child has that already. When it starts screaming, it wants a negative reaction from you. That's what the pain body always wants. Give me more pain. And so it requires considerable presence to hold the space. And many parents just should, they're completely flabbergasted when the children the angel turns into a monster. What is going on here? And then they react. The more unconscious they are, the stronger, the more violent their reaction will be. Their own pain body reacts. They know not what they do. There are several questions. There was just one here and about six or seven others on prayer, the use of prayer, how to use it, whether to use it at all. Now, that word can mean many different things. It can mean going to church and saying, "Please, God, let me have that job. I promise I'll be good. If you only let me have that job. I practiced that as a child. Please let there be some peace in my family." Didn't work. So from somebody who went to church every Sunday, then at 12, I must have decided that there was no point anymore. But there are many different kinds of prayer. There are petitionary prayers. You would like something. They may sometimes work, but you never know whether it was the prayer or you would have gotten it anyway. There are more effective ways if you really feel that you need and want something, but be careful, it won't make you happy, but that's another story. If you really feel you want something, you can use affirmation and visualization. And when you get it, enjoy it. Don't look for yourself in it. Don't look to it for deep inner fulfillment or some kind of permanently enhanced sense of self or permanent happiness. Nothing that you achieve can give you that. Knowing that, you can play around with the world of form. And Jesus already explained how to pray for something. And that is what he said, when you pray for something, feel as if you already had it, as if it had already been given. So you're not saying, "I want something," because if you say, "I want something," it affirms a lack. It says on the other side, the unexpressed side, "I don't have it." So when you say, "I want it," you're also stating that you don't have it. So you're praying at the same time not to have it. If you affirm and visualize that it is already here and you feel as if you had it, that the feeling that you want to get from it, you already have that feeling, and that's the truth. Because you're imagining that it's going to give you feelings of peace or happiness, which is always in you already, if you go inside deep enough. But I don't want to discourage you from playing around in the world of form. So why not try it out? Visualize that it is already yours. You have it. And you feel what you feel as you have it. Thank you for giving me that. It's beautiful, whatever it may be. The house, you're already in it, feels good. Thank you. It's nice to have that house. Thanks. Yeah. It's already there. It's more likely to manifest in that way. And then you move in and you go from there. Then you sit there. You feel, "Oh, great, I've got it." And then the old mind patterns come up in the new house. Then there are other prayers. that are used, they're all in different religions, and they can be called pointers. They are more advanced prayers. They are pointers to a particular state. It's not that uttering those words produces magically the state. What matters when you utter certain words or prayers, then most of them are short, is really the stillness that comes after that. Buddhism, for example, has the metta meditation, which is a kind of prayer, which starts with, I believe, may everybody on this planet be well and happy. And then after you've uttered those words, there's a stillness. And then it says, may everybody in this country be well and happy. Metta means loving kindness, and then there's a stillness. May every being in this city be well and happy. Stillness. May everybody in this house be well and happy. May I be well and happy. And it takes you into stillness. And the being of well and happy is already there in the stillness. It's there, it spreads. You could become still, it would spread anyway, even without the words. Because whatever state of consciousness you are in affects the totality, and in turn is the totality manifesting through you. And we have the beautiful Christian prayer by Saint Francis, I believe. Let me be an instrument of thy peace. Where there is hatred, let me sow love, and so on. Where there is injury, pardon, and so on. And those prayers are openings. They open a door, and they take you into stillness. And they are beautiful. Most prayers operate still on the level of duality. Even when you say, let me be an instrument of thy peace, you are still using the language of duality. There's me, and thy, presumably, is God. There is me, and there is God. So God is perceived still as something or someone separate from me. Nevertheless, it's a beautiful prayer. And if stillness follows the prayer, in the stillness you have transcended duality. There is, some of you are familiar with the Course in Miracles. Course in Miracles, many of those lessons are a kind of prayer. And most of the lessons in it operate on the level of duality, speaking of God as He, and addressing God as something or someone outside of you. Course in Miracles meets you where you are on the level of duality, but as you reach the end of the course, without you noticing it, the lessons become more non-dualistic. And in the end, you end up in stillness. And it says the use for words is almost over now. It's towards the end of the course. So it meets you where you are and takes you by the hand. It only works if you can get hold, if Christian terminology is appealing to you. To some it is not, and then there are many other ways. Don't use something that you don't like, the form of which you don't like. So most prayers are dualistic, and then you can have, although the metta prayer in Buddhism is, may all beings be well and happy, is fine. There's no duality really there, although you're still saying there are many beings. Ultimately, there's only oneness. But what can you do? You're using language. And then there are short things that are almost like mantras, just single words, peace, for example. The word itself doesn't produce peace, but it is a pointer. Stillness. One of the most beautiful pointers to be found in the Old Testament, be still and know that I am God. And this is why, if we can call that a prayer, it is a kind of prayer. It is a prayer where duality is transcended. And it is a miraculous prayer, the words of which it consists are all synonyms for one single thing. Be still, know I am God. Be being, one being, sat in Sanskrit. Being and stillness are one. It is the stillness of being itself before it comes into existence as something. Be still. Know. In the stillness that is being, there is a deep knowing, non-conceptual, a deep intelligence, not words, not thoughts, deeper than thought, because it's the primordial seed of all intelligence. Be still. Know I am. It is the innermost sense of beingness, or I am. God, the divine, the source, the one. And you put these words together, each word signifies also the other. They're all one. Be still, know I am God. Miraculous. So that those are advanced prayers and powerful. They put you in touch. Be still and know that I am God is one of the most powerful and beautiful pointers to the truth, and one of those rare ones that uses language without taking you into duality. Please talk more about the pain body and how to transcend it. We already spoke a little bit, but there are so many questions about the pain body that we may, in tomorrow's session, talk a little bit more about it, unless something else arises in that now. Last one, perhaps, because they're cutting off the satellite dish. As someone who has done a lot of yoga and body work for many years, I always felt there was some correlation between spirituality and good posture. Then I saw you. What a shock. Oh. my first thought was, how can somebody with your posture be so blooming spiritually, and wouldn't you be even more spiritual? If you did some corrective body work. My second thought was that I'm a blooming idiot. And it's, can you tell us how you experience the body and if it ever feels like an impediment to you? That reminds me of I talked to Gangaji, the spiritual teacher, a couple of years ago, and she was telling me she was doing some kind of body work years ago, in, I can't remember what kind. But at that time, she heard of Ramana Maharshi and became interested in the teachings and read a book. And then she saw a picture, a photo of him, and she saw that and said, a man who has such bad posture can possibly have nothing to teach me. He will certainly have nothing to teach me if he walks like that. And it took her several years to transcend that belief. And then she saw that it didn't matter anymore. Sometimes, if the body has gone through a lot of suffering, either physical suffering or psychological suffering, it leaves traces in the body, in the very bones of the body, it leaves traces. In some cases, it's in the face. I knew one spiritual teacher, I won't say who said, look at my face. I always look unhappy. Even when I'm happy, I look unhappy. And that is because I've been unhappy. I was unhappy for so many years. He didn't really. He only looked unhappy if you saw the external features of his face. If you looked more deeply, you could see he wasn't unhappy. But you could see the lines in his face that showed that were the traces left behind by unhappiness. But something else had was now shining through it, through that the form that had been affected by the suffering. And that's the same here. People are surprised when I tell them it's very rare that I ever feel any pain in the body. Only 2 years ago I was at Omega, I had a back pain. I don't know what that was to do with. Maybe the events in New York. I don't know. But usually there's no pain. The body feels fine. And it doesn't seem to be a problem at all. And something else shines through it. So the body has fulfilled its function of being an opening for that. Now, I'm not saying that in many other cases body work is a wonderful thing, to free emotions that may be stuck there. Even the pain body, it's beautiful. It's not ultimately... It could happen to anyone at any moment. It could happen to somebody who is totally crippled. And that has happened too. There was a famous enlightened poet, a teacher who hundreds of years ago wrote the Indian scripture called the Ashtavakra Gita. And he is said to have been a cripple, and it didn't matter anymore. That was his suffering, traces left behind by the suffering. And then the body simply became something through which presence shines. I'll put these back in the basket. Ah. I'm sorry, your question hasn't come up yet. There are many. Thank you. Thank you. Stay a little while, both here and if you're still there, Austin, Hollyhock. Stay a little while with the empty chair or the empty screen. Thank you.
This concludes Lesson 5. Lesson 6, Questions and Answers. The Power of Detachment and Surrender.
We've had the alarm clock for the first awakening, and now comes the real awakening. For some people at Hollyhock, good morning. That may also be the alarm clock because it's 7 o'clock in the morning there. Austin, I don't know, it's 8 or 9 o'clock there. You may be half awake. Here everybody is fully awake in one sense and perhaps also in another sense of the word. As you may have noticed, laughter was an important and is an important part of our gathering. It's very liberating, particularly to laugh at the human condition and to laugh at one's own mind patterns, because it implies that you've taken one step back, a retreat, and have seen your own patterns or your own drama that's produced by the mind patterns. And when you recognize drama as drama, it becomes also funny. Awakening, so, is not a serious business. If you make it serious, then you've gone astray somewhere and the mind is trying to do something. Awakening, a synonym for that, of course, is enlightenment. Another beautiful word, which in the English language, as it so happens, implies two things. There's light in there, enlightenment. It implies light, the light of consciousness, the clarity, the awakened consciousness, the clear seeing, and it implies lightness in the sense of lack of heaviness, gravity, weight, which includes seriousness. Because the mind-made me, the egoic self, takes itself very seriously. It also takes itself and it's very seriously in its attempt to become enlightened. So humor, right humor, not egoic humor. Egoic humor also exists. It might be to laugh at somebody else and think, oh, I'm much, by comparison, I am much more intelligent than this silly person. Laughter frees you up inside. And I hadn't realized until I read some of the questions to you yesterday that every question also seemed to have a funny side. I didn't realize it until everybody started laughing. I'm not waiting for the next sentence to come, and I hope you are not either. If we were waiting, I would be under stress, and you would be impatient. And perhaps you now realize how enjoyable it is when I'm not speaking. We will look at a few more questions, including some questions on the pain body. This is by someone who is sleepless at night. My wife snores. My now at night is miserable. I have tried electronic gadgets and earplugs to no avail. How does one respond and not react? Signed, awake but only at night. P.S. I have tried your cold soup analogy. Sweetheart, would you please stop snoring? It doesn't work. No, of course the cold soup method is not going to work here because snoring is an involuntary process. It just happens. I hope at home you have separate bedrooms. But here, well, any situation that you cannot change, and there are situations of that kind, or situations that you cannot change at this time, perhaps change will be possible at some point, but right now, at this moment, there's nothing one can do. Whether you're in prison or, metaphorically speaking, in prison or have some other condition, some life situation. Now, if there's truly nothing you can do, or there may be something you can do, but there are certain important reasons why perhaps you cannot take action right now. If that is truly so, if you cannot change the situation, there are only two options left. You remove yourself or you surrender. Oh, yes, I forgot the third one. You suffer. and that's always the case, then it's your choice which of the three you choose. Surrender in this case is surrender to the fact that you get woken up several times during the night and then perhaps feel sleepy during the day. But just surrender to, yes, there you are awake again. And then you might use this opportunity and just go into the body. What else can you do? Or shake her. But then it starts again. Or you rent a tent and move into a tent. The thing that doesn't work and that which generates suffering is complaining mentally about the situation, about a situation that you can do nothing about right now. Complaining mentally or complaining also to others, anybody who is prepared to listen to you, you can complain about the situation. And if you observe closely, you see that something in you likes that. Something in you feels strengthened by the complaining, and that's the false sense of self. Whenever you complain, it strengthens the false me, because you are right. The complainer is always right. When is tolerance enabling and or masochism? You may remember we talked about yes to what is not always a yes on the verbal external level. It's an inner attitude, an inner state that you bring to the situation. And out of that inner state of openness and alert attention, which goes with the yes to what is, alert attention, which is intelligence, out of that the right response comes for that situation. And the right response for that situation is not necessarily the word yes, or yes, go ahead. Yes, hit me over the head. Is not necessarily what comes out of your mouth. Out of that, it's quite possible that the word no comes out of your mouth. No. That's not right. That's not it. I'm not going there. So it's be careful not to mistake that state of, because the yes to what is a state of consciousness. It's not the literal, sometimes it is, but it's not always a literal yes that you agree with whatever somebody is doing. Somebody may be at this moment committing an act of violence, and it is within your field of possibility to do something about it. And then you will see the situation and you will act perhaps to stop what's happening. Nobody can predict what you will do out of presence, but it will be right. So there is great strength in the yes to what is, very great strength. Whenever you have said what you had to say, in any situation, step back into stillness. Otherwise, the mind will take over and it will become a non-ending stream of words. You have all witnessed that in other people and perhaps in yourself. People can go on and on about the same thing and again. They're dragged along by a mind stream. Okay, enough, enough, okay. And then they're quiet for 20 seconds. Oh, just one more thing. And while they're quiet for 20 seconds, you can feel the energy built up in them. Like, and that dissolves only through, again, bringing alert attention from where you can observe the mind rather than be it. Your speaking then becomes more powerful. Any words that you say become more powerful because they always come directly out of the stillness. The strange thing is, you may have noticed almost all the questions, the answer to all the questions always takes you back to the same point, the same origin. It's always the same answer in a way, in different aspects. And basically, all the questions are the same question. And once you've gone very deep into the answer, which is in yourself, that's the end of the questions. There's another question on this sheet of paper. How can you witness and feel your feelings at the same time? One could say, you cannot really feel your feelings until you witness your feelings. Because until you witness, you observe, bring awareness to your feelings, you are your feelings. So you don't feel them, you are them. You act them out. And most importantly, your feelings and your thought processes are linked. Feelings energize thought processes that reflect those particular feelings, and the thought processes, the story, adds further energy to the feelings. And this is how certain feelings survive in the body long after an event has passed. which feelings that in an animal would just pass through, in humans gets associated with a story that you can keep telling yourself and others, and so you can keep the feelings alive, the vicious circle. So you're not really feeling your feelings, you are so immersed in them that you are the feelings. So it's called identification. And so when you bring awareness, there is a place from where you can truly feel the feelings. And as you do that, the story is taken out, because awareness replaces thinking. There's a shift then from being identified with the story in the head, the thought processes, to being the aware presence. So you're no longer fueling the feelings with stories in the head. And now you can watch and feel them directly, whatever it may be. Feel it as an energy field in the body. But also be aware of yourself as that which looks, sees, feels the field of attention. In the same way that you look externally at a tree, you are aware of sense perceptions. Flowers, trees, you listen. Bring awareness to sense perceptions. That is an enormous help in bringing awareness to your feelings. The more awareness you bring to sense perceptions, the easier it is to bring awareness to what you feel inside, because it's simply a shift from externally directed awareness. Ultimately, nothing is external, because the entire universe takes place inside you. But let's just put it like that. Externally directed awareness and inner directed awareness. So you are present within and present without. So the enormous importance of being present without, also as far as your inner life is concerned, because it's one awareness. One could ask a similar question. How can I witness eating an apple and feel this, how you're eating the apple at the same time? It's only when you truly are present as you eat the apple that you can truly feel and taste the apple. Before, it's a process that is semi-conscious or even totally conscious. Eating goes back to a very long time. Ingesting substances and you can observe certain humans engaged in intelligent conversation at a dinner table, and the moment they put something in their mouth, they go completely unconscious. They're totally, and they're not really tasting the food, they're just gobbling it down. And then when they've swallowed, they wake up for a moment again, and then they talk about literature or philosophy. But to really eat an apple consciously is a wonderful thing, then you bring something that is usually unconscious, you make it conscious. Maybe that's called tantra, if you do it with sexuality, but it could be any activity that would usually be very unconscious, that is an animal impulse in humans. And you bring consciousness to it, witness it, observe it. It then has a different quality. It becomes beautiful. And then you can truly taste the apple and be present. But there's always more than that which you witness. There is the witnessing presence. Who is that? What is that? That's you. Some people call it the I am. One person, an early 20th century spiritual teacher, Gurdjieff, whom some of you know, spoke of self-remembering. And really what he meant was to remember who it is that is doing this or experiencing this or perceiving this, not the story-based entity, not thinking, okay, I'm John Smith and I'm eating an apple. That's not it. No, John Smith is eating an apple at this moment. No, to sense that which knows, that which is aware, that in you that is aware that there is eating at this moment. So there's awareness of something and at the same time self-awareness of the deepest sense of I. And so that is in any, whether you're eating an apple, watching a tree, engaged in some kind of action or activity, or watching an inner feeling, there's always the manifested and the, one could say, the unmanifested. We called it sometimes the background and the foreground. In the foreground is what happens. In the background is the field, the I am, the deepest I am, in which whatever happens is happening. Now it can happen that the background, that what we call here the background or the ground, which we could call being, the ground of being, it can happen that that ground is so intensely felt, realized, that what is occurring, one could almost say, is a shift. And this is how a deeply awakened being experiences the world. And that shift is what, as you are just awakening, what is foreground becomes the background. And that which you perceived as the background as you were awakening becomes so, it's realized in its vastness that that becomes the foreground. In other words, your sense of beingness, the spacious field of presence, is so vast and all-fulfilling that whatever is happening is just a little, sometimes I call it a ripple on the surface of the ocean, is the event. And you feel your own being or being so strongly that that occupies the entire foreground. And any event is a background, a little background event. And so that is from that place, certain Indian teachers say the world is unreal. It's absurd if we take that as a philosophical proposition and then start believing in it. It doesn't make sense. You can claim 100 times that the world is unreal, but the next moment something happens and you react. So where's the unreality of the world if the world upsets you so much? It was only an idea in the head. But they talk from that place where to them whatever happens is like a dreamlike structure. They can see how quickly it appears, how quickly it disappears. Any event, anything, is fleeting. Of course it is. Right now you're here, in another now, on the same date, totally different surroundings. This has dissolved already. Gone. What hasn't dissolved is that which is aware. So some Indian teachers then from that place where the vastness of the sense of I am or beingness or presence, the stillness could say is so vast, the I alive stillness, that is becomes the foreground and any events become the background. But for many of you, as this is beginning to emerge, it could be better described as you sense it already coming in the background. And that's wonderful. It's more than most human beings on this planet now or in the past ever experienced. It's a wonderful thing. And it's from that place of the background having become the foreground that Jesus could say, I have overcome the world. And it's from that place, perhaps also, that Krishnamurti, once in a talk, he was already quite old, said to his audience, do you want to know my secret? And they'd been coming for 30 years waiting for the secret. And they all said, yes, please. Okay, here it is, he said. I don't mind what happens. I believe this question here has just been answered. You speak of using the senses. To outer presence. What about going deeper and going beyond the senses? If everyone around you is complaining and building their story, what do? Say, is that so all day? comment on their complaining or spend less time with the unconscious people. Some days you would practice all day. The last statement is partially true, and not just some days. You will practice all day. Well, is that so is not necessary to say. The story is the momentum of the egoic mind. It will try to draw you in some way, to make you part of the story. The story, very often in people, is energized even more by their pain body. Then the story can be quite a violent story. So there's a story, but it's energized by enormous emotion, which is past emotion to a large extent, not necessarily generated by this little event that was the triggering event, but the emotion is far deeper. It's human pain that has lived in each human being for millennia and has built up. It is inherited human pain. But what we call pain body, this energy field, this residue of past emotion, of past emotional suffering that lives in humans, tends to use the mind to renew itself, to feed on your thinking. And that becomes the story that is energized by human pain. At other times, it may just be the mind pattern without the energizing effect of the pain body. But even that has a strong pulling power. Your greatest weapon, so to speak, is stillness as you listen to the story. And you will notice that's not a weapon that you can fight actively with, because the moment you fight the story in someone, you've become part of it. Even if you say you're in a story, you're telling, the moment you start talking, that'll become a story. Your story will be that they have a story.
Lesson 6, continued on disc 8.